Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on the companies we mention. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to Monday Upbeat Markets with me, Graham Dixon.
Me, Charles Archer.
Okay, today we are going to meet with David Hanley, the CEO of Gfinity, and talk about lots of stocks. And it's a very warm welcome to David Hanley, the CEO of Gfinity. Hello, David.
Hi, good morning.
And how are you?
Yeah, sunny day in England. It's a good week, I think. There's a lot planned this week.
Okay.
What's going on?
Good to know. Good to know. So for people that don't know about David Hanley as a person, could you give us a background about yourself?
All right. Born and raised in Scotland, Fife, St. Andrews. Left as quickly as I could, went and worked in the city for a bunch of years, then into hedge funds in Mayfair, and then left this country to go and live in Hong Kong for 17 years. Bootstrapped an asset manager with a few partners, sold that, then built an insurance broking company which specialized in really complicated things. And we led the market pretty much almost globally in cryptocurrency exchange insurance. Sold that, came back to England, bought out Afloss from Gfinity, the gaming software company. And then Gfinity asked me to fix them because they were in rough state and they were struggling as a company. So I came as CEO. That's a quick story.
It's a very quick story. I mean, how did you actually come across Gfinity / Afloss? What was the connection?
So I've been a long-term friend of the number one shareholder in Gfinity, and obviously I represent a lot of capital in Asia, so they asked me initially to see if I could raise capital to take Afloss forward and make it successful. That's when I did the DD on Gfinity, and I'm an operator, right? I'm not a sort of finance guy or anything. I operate companies. I've run a bunch of companies over the years, and they needed a huge cost reduction at that point. They were burning six figures a month.
Yeah, and from what I remember, you were like the smiling assassin.
Yep. My HR person was the assassin. I smiled.
Exactly. And yep. your biggest shareholder is Robert Keith. But he uses a vehicle. It's not in his personal name. Am I right in saying that?
Charles Street.
Charles Street. Okay.
Funnily enough, is the street where I worked in my hedge fund. So I was in 16 Charles Street in my hedge fund.
Charles Street,
yeah. Okay. Correct. Just by Curzon Street.
Okay. All right. Robert Keith, I mean, he made his money through Eidos. Am I correct?
Eidos, which is Lara Croft, Tomb Raider, and quite a few other really successful investments. He's very well known in the sort of small cap sector in the UK and Scandinavia. He's been crazy successful as an investor. He's actually really shrewd and a very, very good person to be able to ask advice off. He understands the market better than anybody I've met.
Right. Okay. He's been very patient because he's been in Gfinity for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. He's seen it go up and down over the years. And at one point, it was worth
his average
8 million price. Valuation. They burned 55 million quid of capital during that period. Wow. Esports growth.
That was the free money period, wasn't it?
Right, and they didn't understand. Right, and they didn't understand at that point. I think that 80 million share capital is a huge amount of money you can use to invest in other things and buy things.
Hmm.
And they made one acquisition, mainly other apart from small things, a Stock Informer, which was a sort of a late cycle investment, not an early cycle investment.
Yes, yeah. Well, what does tell us about the old Gfinity and what remains of it?
So there was basically three aspects to it, right? There was the esports events, which, you know, the Saudis came to dominate. They bought Facet and for $1 billion, which was one of the big competitors to Gfinity. Esports events, you don't own the IP, right? So there's no real value. You don't accrue value as you build it. You're always just resetting to zero. So I culled that immediately. We had a digital media business with huge costs. I scaled it down enormously. We integrated a lot of cost efficiencies and centralization, right? So there was basically everyone was a silo at that point. I centralized every single cost into one editor, basically. We do use AI tools, not to write, but for a lot of economies of scale. We're really early to that. I think we're ahead of all the publishers in cutting costs and doing it this way, and everyone's copied. We have a load of social media channels, which they were making zero from. They saw it as a feeder to the websites, whereas I saw it as a means of income, not a feeder to websites, because you don't particularly go on social media now and click through the websites. So that's now a six-figure income and growing by 20% a month. You know, it's not significant for a company, but it's significant when you've got such small costs that it really makes it a big dent. So it means the digital media is profitable every month. And then obviously the last bit was Athlos, which we had to exit because that was costing £125,000 a month. It was run, like if you inject a bunch of corporate guys into a company, they'll always say, well, let's put four managers with big salaries in and then we'll think about it. And it just wasn't sort of not a way you can run a small cap company, right? I think ultimately when you've got a small single digit million company, you've got to run it like a sort of bootstrap startup until you get to that place where you've got a decent valuation.
Yeah, well, you got to run it as though it's your own private company, right?
Yeah.
You know, and like when I invest through my own vehicle, as I'm sure we all do, you're very, very careful about where you put your money and where it gets spent, right?
Yeah.
And yet there's a lot of public companies that just don't seem to care at all. And then they come cap in hand asking their investors for more capital. And it's kind of funny because, you know, we probably, you know, I do anyway, I'm certain you two do as well. You work with a lot of private companies. And where they spend the money is kind of almost forensically examined when they come to ask for more. And yet the public companies seem not to be too stressed about it. And then they wonder why they're issuing a huge discount warrants and everything else. It's because you burnt through it and didn't spend it wisely. So it's nice to hear a little bit of financial discipline here.
I sign off every single expense, funny enough. I always remember in Hong Kong, I had a friend. He had a huge revenue business and he just couldn't make profits. And he decided to go down so granular in the cost base and basically sign off everything down to paperclips almost. Mm. And his margins exploded. And it was just that simple thing about increasing revenues to get that cost base down. It was all stuck with me, his sort of a message from all those years ago.
Yeah. Well, I think it's quite fun. My brother owns a restaurant up in Gloucestershire. And obviously minimum wage has gone up and taxes have gone up and employers' national insurance has gone up. So you're sitting there thinking, you know, what's the solution? The solution, obviously, is to put up prices because there's nothing else you can do. And you think the market won't absorb it, but it will, you know? And I think this is the problem that, you know, on the flip side of that, it's the other thing, you know, the cost control is one half of the equation. The other half is setting pricing and understanding that we, you know, it's funny because even in the past of like 10 years or so, like a £20 note 10 years ago felt like a lot of money, regardless of what your income was. And now £20 feels almost like nothing, right?
Yeah.
And that's nothing to do with, you know, how much you earn. That's just you walk into a shop and you spend 20 quid on like three things. So, you know, the market will bear more. And when you're setting pricing for what you're doing at Gfinity now, you've got to put that into perspective as well. You want to keep your costs disciplined, but also you want to sell as much as possible for the highest price you can. And I'm guessing that you're kind of testing those price structures now, would be my guess.
Price is a huge part of the way forward, part of our message, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me about the plan going forward for Gfinity. What's the structure of the business and what are the key elements?
Right, so it sort of goes back to when I joined, actually, and I kept saying that the next massive wave is AI. You know, I sort of joined banking in 99, so I saw the back end of the dot-com boom. I didn't really benefit from it. I actually felt the brunt of the back end of it. I'm not going to miss this one. Mm-hmm. So funny enough, when I joined Gfinity, I was going to rename it Vertical AI PLC. I even bought the domain name and everything. I was just too early. People wouldn't buy into it. I was like, AI, this is the wave. You've got to be involved in it. But the point was, you could, as a business now, AI can be centralized, the same as it did for digital medias. If you've got a tech team and a data team and a machine learning guys, you can run 50 companies around them as long as you've got salespeople for those 50 companies. You kind of silo the sales, but you kind of keep the centralized running. And that's why I keep saying to everyone, I think the future of public market companies is going to be sort of big conglomerate style model with lots of smaller companies underneath them. I think having one idea is just so dangerous anyway, because you can be sort of competed out so easily with technology. So the way forward was to You know, to find initially a core AI business and then to build around that, a lot of the sort of infrastructure in sales. I've run sales teams my whole career, and that was always the focus at go to market. So I was helping with Connected IQ with Robert and Andrew, who's the director of Connected IQ, and I basically talked him into letting us bring it into the publicity company because I felt it would be a really interesting asset for a publicity company. We've got what CIQ does, Connected IQ does, is it focuses on connected television. And connected television is two things. It's online video, which is videos on you'd see on YouTube, whatever. And then you also have CTV, which is broadcasters like ITVX or Channel 4. You have subscription CTV, which is Netflix or something, or Paramount. Then you have the advertising supported ones, which are, you know, these weird fast channels, which are free. And what Connected IQ does, allows advertisers to invest their advertising dollars into these channels, knowing they'll get a proper ROI, not to some strange video, and by using context and using the sort of emotions of it. So a good example is last night I was watching Alex Rider, a TV show with my son, and
Anthony Horowitz.
Yeah, exactly, right?
And it's I didn't know that existed. I know there's a film. I have to watch it. Okay.
So there's a TV show, yeah. And it's funny because it's a spy show, right? So it should be like high tech and things. And Amazon obviously decided to advertise their own, and this is on Prime, yes? So it's Amazon advertise their own home technology kit on it. It's talking about how to be high tech. At 1 second after, there'd just been a massive hack on the Alex Rider show. So, and then basically they'd taken over the guy's whole house with of his whole home entertainment system. And it's the context of it. It was a terrible time to advertise, the right place to advertise, a terrible time to advertise.
Mm.
So the return on that is awful because you've just been told, buy from us after it's shown how dangerous it is to have in your house.
Yeah.
That's the whole point of context. You see it everywhere, right? You see it on YouTube, a lot of places. These tech companies don't know how or don't want to know how to advertise. They don't want to know because they don't want to stop people advertising these places. They want to keep the volume of adverts up, right? Yeah. What we've done is we've built an engine which allows advertisers to confidently advertise in video, which is much more complicated than a static website, right? Because it's moving all the time. You know, your channels can be varying from something that's really outrageous to something which is acceptable. And it allows them to perform that. Now, obviously, they've got all sorts of other tools to use advertisers. And this is just a critical part of the data signals. And it can create a much, much higher ROI. And I think in this world where people are watching their cost base hugely, is very, very important. The one thing about CIQ, which is really interesting, is that we built it really, really, really cheaply because everyone else came before the modern technology was available. We built in the last year, but really smartly. So our cost, the cost of using us is probably 80% less than any competitor.
And that's your economic moat.
Yes, if you go to somebody and go like, yeah, you can have, we don't need to outperform them. We can just be the same as the old guys on the old technology.
With a better margin.
Right, because one thing is media agencies in particular are desperate for margin. They're struggling as businesses right now. You see WPPs and these guys.
Yeah.
Desperate for success. So for them to be offered the same thing way cheaper and increase their own margins, it's just a massive message. And I was actually surprised sitting in with some of the big holdco, the big top five advertising agencies, and seeing their responses to costing, because I came in as skeptical as a non-advertising person, thinking it can't just be that easy. But, you know, we're having so much interest right now.
Yeah, but honestly, it often is that easy, right? Like, I write a Substack on AIM stocks, right, predominantly. Nobody else does. It is that easy to just start writing, but people choose not to. And often if there's a gap in a business, then you can kind of understand why. I mean, as you were talking, something kind of jogged my memory. So we've got the Chancellor is reducing the cash ISA allowance, kind of push people towards investing in the stocks, which seems like a bad idea when we could be on the precipice of a stock market crash. Hopefully it won't happen. But it's that idea that you want to advertise and you want to advertise your stuff where you're going to be confident it's not going to backfire. And that's the solution that you've put in. I mean, I spent a lot of time doing marketing for kind of big blue chip companies. And I would say in this world of artificial intelligence in particular, a lot of what used to work in terms of marketing or search engine optimization just doesn't work anymore.
No.
You know, a lot of budgets are being cut, and where the money is spent is it's more and more important that it's spent in a way that stands out. And you're kind of, you know, if you're advertising a product, you know, or you're trying to get clients and you're using artificial intelligence to do so, so is everybody else. So it's more of the sameness. Whereas if you can cut through the noise, I mean, me with like a personal voice or you with a product that is able to intelligently target your audience in a way that doesn't irritate them in a video format, which nobody else can do at a margin no one else can do, then that's something that's, you know, it doesn't mean it's guaranteed to work, but it's definitely something worth investigating. And that's probably where you're landing at the moment.
Yeah, I think, and you know what? And the thing for us is we're built as a tech company, whereas a lot of the guys are just advertising people.
Yeah.
And my attitude is, you know, the way I run tech is I'll build, then stop building completely and just focus on commercial. And when commercial starts to take off, we'll build again. So it creates this like real kind of, this really tight cost control. But it means that the next wave of building is going to be really interesting, because I think we'll be able to our learnings off the big hold calls will be massive.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Well,
it's the data sets, right? The data is worth more than anything. But the other thing is, if your margins are as, you know, good as you say they are, presumably you can offer contracts, you know, as you say, cheaper, but you can implement what you're doing fairly cheaply. And then, you know, you can reel clients in, right?
Yeah.
And once they, you know, because actually it's kind of, not even kind of, I know this from experience, it's very difficult to get new clients to sign up for new ways of doing things, because you're spending, you know, the reason why you think it's going to work is that, you know, they're being very careful with money. That's also the reason why it's hard to get them to sign up in the first place. But if you get them to sign up, and that's all to do with your sales team, whether that's you or others, then, you know, if it does work, which it will, then getting more and more contracts, more revenue, it snowballs very quickly. But I think, you know, it sounds to me like it'll be the case will be smaller contracts to start with, and then it'll snowball very fast. Is that the strategy?
Yeah, look, we started, I thought, you know, in advertising, you have the indie agencies, right? The sort of independent guys. Then you have the top five holdcos in WPP, to OMG, IPG, which were emerging. And the rest. And so what surprised me is the openness of the big guys. And it's been quite shocking. And in November, I hired my first proper commercial guy. I brought basically make turning it into our company, to my sales company. And bought the second commercial guy in January, and they've just opened so many doors because their connections and their business is huge. So it's quite interesting. I've got a great data science guy, and then I've got these two advertising people, and I come in with my finance maths, and I keep challenging them all because I'm like, well, actually, you know, in finance, because coming from a hedge fund background, that we think a bit differently about this, and we're bringing a whole new ideas into it. But you know, the world has changed, technology's changed, and all these companies are scrabbling.
Well, it's the world has changed, Matt. I mean, it's funny because the work I did when I first started, you know, doing copywriting, you know, after a brief stint in law, that work doesn't exist anymore. Artificial intelligence does it, you know, and some of the more complex work that I do for blue chip clients like crypto.com as their analyst, or, you know, in New York, or for IG Index in London, a lot of that work is starting to be automated as well. So, you know, not only are you as a company trying to gain clients, you're also having to adapt to a world which is changing so rapidly, to the point where it's funny because, you know, large language models, if you think sort of ChatGPT, its first iteration to the public, that was what, November 2022, you know? We're barely 3 years later, and what's changed so far has just been incredible. What was it like 3, 4, 5 years down the line? You know? And so these ad agencies, a lot of them are seeing their share prices fall and their revenues fall. And it feels to me almost like they're being forced to open their eyes and look for ways, you know, to beat the competition, to try different things. Because if you don't try different things, then the share price is just going to keep falling. So, you know, I wouldn't use the word desperation yet, because it's not desperation, but they're kind of, they have their larger investors are saying, you need to make changes or we're going to get out. And so they are, you know, being a bit more adventurous, even if they have to be more careful with the money at the same time.
Yeah. And you see that in WPP, right? That what's happened to their shares. Internally, they've had to massively restructure. But they're embracing AI to an extent, but I think corporates just get stuck in developing technology. They just can't build fast enough. This is the beauty of small caps. I think there'll be a huge run of acquisitions by the big agencies at some point before this technology.
Yeah, well, I think it's, I mean, I work with both, right? I work with private companies, I work with small caps, but I work with much larger companies. The larger companies have a lot more money, but they are not able to pivot very quickly. They're not nimble, they're not focused. You have like, you know, it's just like night and day, right? Like if you have a problem and it's a small cap, the speed at which you can address the problem is just aeons faster than if you're doing it for a large company. A large company, right, first you've got to go talk to compliance and wait 6 months for it to come out of their pipeline end. And then they've got a load of problems and you have to do it again. And then you have to go to the sales team. And then you have to go to like 43 different managers, all have to sign it off, by which point the market's changed, the product you're creating doesn't work anymore. Or alternatively, you can just buy it out from the smaller companies, what works, and then integrate it. And then you have these kind of weird kind of zombie companies where there's loads and loads of different integrations, but that's preferable because they can't develop it themselves. So yeah. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, the one thing that I think artificial intelligence will do, it'll make bolting on acquisitions a lot more smooth than it's been in the past. So it'll be easier for companies to integrate them.
That's what I've noticed. I've looked at a few options to buy companies recently. I'm quite interested in M&A, and for me to adopt a tech stack in our company is so easy now because I've got a really good tech team, and sort of people. You can run the code against AI to check it, and you know you can take the repositories and like GitHub or something. I'm not an engineer, but even I'm confident that we can take on any tech stack and run it really easily with just one or two people. So you can take these companies with big engineering teams and just cut them off.
Yeah, and the other thing is that the core personnel, you acquire the tech, there are core personnel.
Yeah.
The job market has changed as well. You know, I freelance. All the people I know who make decent money now are freelancing or working for themselves. So if you need them to come as consultants for a few months or a year at a day rate that, you know, is probably higher than what they were on, but a hell of a lot cheaper than having the whole team.
Yeah.
You know, that's also an option. You know, so it's the world has changed. Sounds like you're changing with it. And hopefully, you know, it goes the way you want it to. The share price goes to the moon and we all retire millionaires.
Yeah.
Sound like a plan.
We definitely need that share price up. I think it's last week was a good week, 20%, but that was just bouncing back to where it should be, really.
Mm. David, just tell us about your cash position, because from what I could see, you know, you had about £400,000 in cash in December. How are you managing that cash? And, you know, are you looking to unlock those warrant positions?
It would be great to get the price up through sort of 10, 12, to start getting some warrants moving. We're okay for cash because we have a very low cost base. The digital media business runs itself and makes a profit. KinetiQ is very low cost base, right? It's actually, for what we do, it's very, very, very low. And when we start properly generating revenue, and we're seeing a lot of interest, and we're doing a lot of tests right now, the revenue should jump up very quickly. So, we live in a place where I think any capital would be deployed, we'd have to, if we raised any more capital, it'd have to be for a return investment of, you know, when the market carries the right amount, we can buy out KinetiQ fully, which is important, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to do acquisitions going forward because there's always opportunities. And as I said before, I can basically take a tech and just roll into our system and cut every cost from it.
Yeah. Okay. And I mean, in terms of you promoting Gfinity, I see that you're quite active yourself now on LinkedIn, a little bit on Twitter. But I also noticed that Gfinity has a huge following, 135,000 followers. Do you see, you know, that being used, or is it just purely gamers that are on that side? It's got nothing to do with the actual business, the overall business, especially in the new direction you're going.
Yeah, I've had quite a lot of success in my own sort of account because keeping to the sort of narrow band of, you know, small cap investors in UK. But as we grow, I think that'll become a much more important channel.
Mm.
The other thing is, you know, 153,000 people interested in small cap investing more want to know what the latest computer game is, the video game is, whatever. It'll be a very, very good vehicle forward. Obviously, we have a team of content writers as well, so it's so easy to build an IR model. I, you know, I, I use AI a lot for everything in my life, and it helps me build all sorts of things. And talking to markets is really important. I think we went through a very quiet period because it was a rebuild phase. We just brought on commercial people. Everyone's always asking for trading updates, but where you've had your one commercial guy for a month, there's not much that they can have done in a month.
Mm.
So the goal is this year to really ramp up, you know, information to markets. As you know, I've invested in lots of small caps, and I've invested my whole life, and I know the pain of just wanting some sort of update. You have to be sort of have built into that place and built enough sort of scale of news to keep that flow going. And that's where we're getting to now. It really feels like we're turned a corner. Really did feel the last couple of weeks, you know, we've had some really interesting conversations.
Yeah. So, it's clear to see with the way the share price is going. Okay, so these are the questions that Kevin Hornsby loves to ask. You're on death row. Keir Starmer says you've made too much money through Gfinity, and you're going to be executed. So what is your final meal going to be?
That's pretty tough, isn't it? Just now, I'm going for a meat phase, so it'd have to be some sort of steak. Historically, it may have been vegetarian. I always do my biohacking stuff all the time. You know what? That last day is going to have a really good workout, really good dinner. A nice glass of red wine.
Oh.
And then the dessert is the important aspect to that, I think. It's going to have to be a very, something potentially chocolatey and very sort of almost like a raw chocolate dessert.
Raw chocolate.
I want to go to the gallows feeling very good, feeling very healthy. That's the key. Yeah.
All the way to the end, staying healthy.
Exactly.
What would you say is the best piece of advice you've ever received, and what's the best piece of advice you've dished out?
You know what? So it's not one piece of advice, but I got sales training when I was 21. I worked at Standard Life, and my first ever job was I worked in telesales for years, which is one of the greatest trainings you'll ever receive in your life. And I did a sort of 2-month sales training process with these incredible trainers, and that changed everything for me. You know, it taught me NLP, it taught me all the processes of sales, and turned me into like a really, really powerful salesperson. And that stands out as by far the best sort of advice process, I'd say, I got.
Okay.
And then the best advice I've given, never have more than one business partner.
Okay.
You know what? Success is always in twos, right? You look at Apple, you look at Google, you look even at Microsoft at the start. When there's three, it's chaos. There's always two disagreeing and one being the sort of the rule maker, who's usually the one who has the least say, least opinion. Never have three people start a company.
Interesting. What's the best way of people finding you then on Twitter and LinkedIn?
The David Halley on X.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I reside, and obviously I'm LinkedIn.
Yeah, great stuff. All right, David. Well, thank you so much for coming on to Monday Upbeat Markets, especially at short notice. And I'm looking forward to seeing Gfinity thrive.
See you guys.
Thanks a lot. In the meantime, Charles, what do you have to say about the markets?
What do I have to say about the markets? Well, we're in this kind of Schrodinger's Hormuz at the moment, aren't we? Where that the Strait of Water is neither closed nor open. And the US has decided they're going to keep it closed. And Iran has decided they're going to keep it closed. So it seems that everything seems to be falling out of the bottom of the market. And yet, shares are fine, mostly. You know, things are just keep continuing going as normal.
Yeah.
And it does seem to me like the market thinks a deal was on the horizon in the next few weeks, no matter what the headlines say. What do you think?
You know, I find it like this information war, right, or disinformation war that's going on between Trump and Iran. You know, who do you believe? Trump says, you know, they've got nothing left. There's hardly anything left. And Iran says, no, we've got plenty of ammunition. We've got plenty of options available to us to disrupt whatever you want to do. So you keep going. So I don't know, you know, who's telling the truth? I mean, you know, I guess, I mean, what do you think? Who is telling the truth?
Well, I think it's, you know, if the US were to conduct a land invasion and invade Iran, they'd wipe them out very quickly, right? But they don't want to do that. So all Iran has to do is keep the strait closed, which is very cheap. You just need mines and drones. So, you know, Iran might be a much weaker power militarily, but it actually makes no real difference at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you not think that they have the Americans and the Israelis have the technology to take the drones out? You know, from these.
I think all, you know, if you look at Russia and Ukraine, it turns out that, you know, the thing is, drones are cheap, and dealing with drones is very expensive. So you have hundreds of drones attacking a ship, and you want to get through, and that's that. But I think in terms of it, what's quite interesting again is the longer term implications of supply chain security. So helium is a good example. Sulfuric acid is another. Oil, obviously. Yeah. I think across the world, nations are going to want to diversify supply chains and then become, you know, autarky, become more self-sufficient. Regardless of when the strait opens or not. So, you know, we shall see. But I think the biggest problem with it is that if it stays closed for another a few more weeks, then the serious problems are going to start. But I just can't see that happening, it staying closed much longer, because the damage done to every country in the world, including Iran, would be so massive, the juice isn't worth the squeeze for anybody. Having said that, Trump even needs to escalate, which will be disastrous for the US, particularly with midterms coming up, or he needs to de-escalate, which the EU can't do. So he's kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, is what it feels like.
I'm just trying to work out, Charles, I mean, we, you know, with... US saying, well, we're pretty self-sufficient on the oil and gas front. We don't really need the Strait of Hormuz. It doesn't really affect it. Yet he wants to keep the Strait of Hormuz open. And I'm trying to work out why is it important and not important to him at the same time?
Well, I think it's honestly, it's hard to know, you know, what goes through Donald Trump's mind. It's madder than a bag of cats, that man. But I think it's the problem is that the US, and this has been the way since its inception as a country, is that it wants to be isolationist. It wants to be completely self-sufficient, have everything that it wants. But it lives in a globalized world, and it basically wants to be isolationist, but it also wants to maintain the supremacy of the US dollar. And so you can't do both things. And this closure of Iran is, you know, potentially marks the start of the end of the petrodollar. And that's, you know, a huge change that's going to occur. But I don't know. I think one of the key problems is, you know, when you're looking towards a ceasefire/peace deal, the red lines that the Iranians have are very different from the red lines the US has. And eventually there's going to have to be a compromise force. The problem I worry about is that when that peace deal eventually comes, it'll be very much Treaty of Versailles. If you remember your World War One history peace deals, it'll be a deal that won't last because both sides are unhappy with it. And that's the real problem that you have. You know, we will see.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. In terms of stocks, anything really catching your eye at all?
There's a few. I think in terms of RNSs, it was kind of on the light front for a Monday. Usually you have like 93, but it just doesn't seem to have happened. I think it's, you know, it's funny because you're told that companies have to release material information the moment they get it, right? And yet when there's like really bad geopolitics going on in the world, it feels like there's good RNSs, the good information is kept from being released from one way or another. Saw that after the ceasefire, there was suddenly a massive slurry of news coming out. I do think that with the Hornet situation, I think that, you know, Helix Exploration, Pulsar, you know, those helium explorers / with proven reserves in the US.
Haven't they?
They're positioned extraordinarily well, and it's because it's becoming, like the tungsten trade with, you know, Guardian Metal, UWMO and others, it's becoming, you know, a national security concern. So yeah, the chance of getting government involvement in those stocks, you know, very shortly, I think, is quite high. Common sense, isn't it?
Government involvement, I mean, this is like unheard of about 3 or 4 years ago.
It's the thing is, it's hilarious to me because tungsten, for example, I was looking at this back in 2022, 2023, and it was obvious what was going to happen, and now there's basically no ceiling on the price. And you've now got the nuclear fusion trade. So with tungsten, you know, China banned exports. to hurt the US initially, but now it's importing as much as it can to get ahead on the fusion race. Because the first country that sold nuclear fusion probably solves AGI. But I mean, there's applications for fusion that people you can't even imagine. Like, for example, colonizing Mars becomes possible because you have infinite energy. Do you know? It's things just completely off the scale.
Yeah.
You can't even imagine. And the only way to create fusion reactors is if you have tungsten because of its chemical properties. So, but I think just more generically in terms of stocks on the market that, keeping an eye on, it seems that governments around the world are investing into resource stocks, even at the junior level. And so, you have this competition for capital. Brokers are offering money, but then suddenly you've got funds offering money, you've got high net worths offering money, you've got governments offering money. And so the terms the money is coming on, it's much larger amounts of money, and it's also better terms as well for investors. Mm. But I think for me, it's anyone who's got helium, anyone who's got tungsten, anyone who's got titanium, anyone who's got specialty defense metals, where you suddenly got these pinch points. Obviously, the rare earth trade is doing extraordinarily well and probably continue to do so. But it's...
I mean, some of these rare earth companies have really come off the ball, though. If you're following Pensano and Wakango, I mean, their shares have effectively halved in the last...
Yeah, well, they come up, they come down, but I think that's kind of standard with rare earth plays, because rare earth is still a small market. Mm. And the problem is that all of these stocks now are completely detached from their fundamentals one way or another. They're being driven by sentiment. And yeah. So, people, it'll spike up, people take profit, it'll come down, then it'll spike back up again. And I think the biggest thing with all of these stocks is that so many of them have been so undervalued for so long that nobody really knows where fair value is for any of them. You have stocks with like JORC resources of gold or copper or tungsten or titanium in the ground that are valued at literally cents on the dollar that should do 10, 20, 30x returns. But you can't quite believe that's possible if you've already had a 10x return on it. And I think that's where it's going to get bounced up and down. And Kango, I think, probably has a great future ahead of it over the next few months. But the other thing is it's almost that sort of leave something for the next man, right? Like if you've had a 10 or 20 or 30x return on a stock, there might be more in it. But there's in terms of risk management, and I know you're not a fan of risk management, there's a big part of most people that go, well, I've made a huge amount of money, I should take some off the table now. And that's probably what's happened with those.
Yeah, very interesting. Actually, talking about a stock that's gone up a lot is IQE. I don't know if you follow it, the semiconductor company.
Yeah.
1,000% since December. It's up, I think, 50% today. It's in the M&A situation, and I think it's on the back of increased defense spending, increase in spending in AI data centers, and something to do with wireless sales. But and then the audio boom, I've noticed, about 30% since middle of last week, and it's about this time last year when they came out with the trading statement. So they're in an M&A situation. See what they've got to say.
Yeah, well, it's funny, like Kraken Robotics I was covering a couple of years ago, and that's up 1,000%. But even like FTSE 100, right, like since the pandemic lows, Rolls Royce, tons of AIM investors bought into that when it was, including myself, when it was trading at virtually nothing. We've seen extraordinary returns.
Yeah.
And that's obviously the defense angle, but also, airline flights.
Nuclear. And,
nuclear, small modular reactors.
Yes.
And if we would stop dragging our feet on those, we'd probably have them halfway built by now. But there we go. That's the government for you.
I know. It's banging our heads against the wall, I'm sure.
Forever and a day. But moving on.
Well, that was an eye-opening interview with David Halley. And very grateful for him to come on to the show short notice. Let's see what happens there. Thank you so much for tuning in. It's a short one this time. But remember, if you like what you see, please like and subscribe. And remember, mum's the word.
This podcast was brought to you by Monday Upbeat Markets. If you would like to appear on a future episode of the Mum's Podcast, please email mondayupbeatmarkets@gmail.com.